Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 117, American Buddhism.
There's a lecture called Buddhism Without Buddhism. And a lot of people from many groups in San Francisco came, then they were a little upset and distressed as I was going on about how to really make Buddhism useful in America, we didn't need Buddhism. And in fact, Buddhism as a sort of entity perceived by Americans as that religion, Buddhism, was even a kind of hindrance to offering to them, you know, the services that the Buddha's offering to people walking around here, which are the services of mindfulness, the services of gentleness, the services of how to produce mindfulness and gentleness, the services of improving their health, the healing medicine. There's research that Ayurveda, which now the Brahmins think they came straight out of the head of Brahma, actually was spread by Buddhist monks throughout India. Because the Brahmins didn't want to touch the, you know, the lower caste people, so they couldn't really do mass medicine. Whereas the monks were out there dealing with whatever it was, whatever difficult diseases there were, and they were spreading that, you know. And so the services are what are really useful, which will make America happier. And then naturally, once they're happier and jollier, they won't think you're totally insane for walking around and thinking that the world is nirvana, which is what we think. And then even, yesterday I found from even the Theravadins, you're just as non-dualist as us. You can't get away with any dualism. I'm sorry. You know Nagasena, the Reverend Great Bhikkhu Nagasena. When Nagasena, he lets some people, like the King Menander was talking to him, and Menander was saying, well, is there a way I can get to Nirvana out of this mess? It must be somewhere. And yeah, you can get there, and he says, you go and be virtuous and do this, do that, the other, and you'll get to Nirvana. And he lets him think of it as if it was someplace else. And then the king, who's very clever, then the next dialogue, he says to him, well now, where? Tell me where? Is it east, west, south, north, up, or down? No, it's nowhere like that, says Nagasena. Nirvana's not any other place. He says, Nirvana is here, he said. It's like fire, he said. You don't think fire is here, but if you rub some sticks together very strongly, fire will burst forth. So that's totally non-dualist. So thanks, Theravada, for being so one dharma non-dual. And don't give us this stuff about we Mahayana people are like that, you know. And like some of the real conservatives, they think that Nagarjuna was I don't know what. That's not still today, here and there, we have pockets of that. But that's really wrong. And also we shouldn't think Theravada is just some sort of dualist. Theravadins are non-dualist. Everybody's non-dualist. Third noble truth is non-dualism. Of the four noble truths, they're not all equally real. First, second, and fourth are a little bit unreal. They're relative only, right? The only ultimately real one is nirvana. And ultimately real doesn't mean later. It means now, here and now. But I'll come back to that at the end of the talk, which, by the way, when is the end of the talk? How long?
You have until 9 o'clock.
Till 9 o'clock. Okay. Oh, good. Excellent. Captive audience at 9 o'clock. So I thought what we would do then to look at Buddhism as the matter. Of course, Buddhism is legal. This is America in the 20th century. And the Republicans did not control the government yet. You know? And so it is still legal. And even in Louisiana or Alabama, it's still legal. And so Buddhism, anybody wants to have an institution, is fine, you know. But the point is, where you know, where are the services? Like Naropa University. I can praise Naropa University because you teach all kinds of other things that aren't Buddhism as well. And the idea is like a liberal arts thing that has the core element of mindfulness and sitting and vipassana, critical insight, and that's the core instead of, you know, the Bible, you know, the Gospels, like Amherst College, where I used to teach, founded by Methodists, you know, Congregationalists founded Harvard. I think Columbia, luckily, were founded by a bunch of New Yorkers, so I'm safer. I always feel safer there. I always feel safer there. But, you know, every other WASP place, you know. So it's just the Buddhist core place. But you teach every other thing. That's good. And you let the Buddhist sensibility seep around into other kinds of studies. And therefore, in a way, you are offering more than, you're offering Buddhism in an indirect way of where people can learn French better, or Sanskrit better, or Tibetan better, or engineering better, or psychology better, if they learn to watch their mind and they learn to get rid of their inner voice of paranoia and so forth, you know. Or not get rid of it, of course, label it, watch it, and send it off. Send it off to have some Prozac. And I always praise Jon Kabat-Zinn for, you know, offering in hospitals mindful MSBR. Or MBSR, yeah, MBSR. And Americans are happy when they have something that they don't know what it means, you know. And so it doesn't sound Buddhist, you know, MBSR. Oh, yeah, I went and did some MBSR, no problem. Add that to every other PPQ and whatever. And then they can improve their heartbeat and they can survive after their heart attack. And usually people are nicer after their heart attack. So it's better that they survive a bit longer, you know, usually. With the eating Dean Ornish's vegetarian diet.
Oh, my God.
So, and then I like to praise Hiroshi. Where's Hiroshi? The peacemaker, order. I like to praise him. Because he goes out on the street. He's been trying to drag me out there for years. But I'm always in the street. I'm a New Yorker, Hiroshi. I was born here. But I'll get out there one day. But anyway, he always goes there. He goes to prisons. He wants to be activist, which is really wonderful. That's really good. And he's not demanding that every bum in the Bowery become Buddhist. Or every prisoner. Just learn to be a little more happy and more cheerful. That's the main thing. So what I thought we would do is we would look at Buddhism in terms, therefore, American Buddhism in terms of its services. In terms of the Eightfold Path. And we have realistic worldview is the first. And I don't like right, probably because I'm usually wrong. That's why I don't really like right. But I just don't like that, because right and wrong, you know, like somebody made some rule and they ordered you to do it, and then you're either right or wrong, and then you get a check mark or you get a black mark. Whereas the Yandagwa, Samyak, you know, Samyak means real. And so Samyak, you know, in Samasambuddha, you know, in Pali, you know, And therefore real means realistic. And that's my definition of Buddhism, actually. Nowadays, when people ask me what's like the essential definition of Buddhism? Buddhism is realism, basically. That's all it is. Because it's based on the faith we get by listening to Buddha, that if we knew reality perfectly, we'd be in bliss. And we would be able to even help others reach that bliss. Because that's what reality is. Therefore, the more we can discover reality, the more happy we are. The more we distort reality, hide from reality, the more ignorant we are, the more we suffer. So the suffering is based on being unrealistic, and being realistic creates happiness. Right? You follow me? So in that sense, really, that's what Buddhism is. It's not a religious thing. It's not like some pie-in-the-sky belief, you know, that somebody's going to do something for you later. It's being realistic. What is really here? And when you really look at the suffering here, it disappears under analysis. And then that's a relief. That's enough relief to call it bliss. It's not worldly happiness that then would change back to suffering, but it's a deeper bliss that comes right up out of the nature of reality, because it is the nature of reality. Don't you think?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So realistic worldview. What is realistic worldview? American Buddhism, how will it have realistic worldview? Well, who are the people in the West who in America who think they're trying to be realistic? The scientists, obviously. Therefore, this dialogue thing with the scientists is not just like Dalai Lama's little cute, like, eccentricity. It is something essential to everyone. It is what everyone should be doing. Yeah, I have to praise Mr. Engel over there. He has been really promoting that for 25 years. You shouldn't be tired because of doing that. You should be happy. You should get more energy because it's so excellent thing to do. Because why? The thing that is against Buddhism in this country is taught in science classes. Not just what's taught in churches or in other things, in science classes. The scientific materialism or materialistic scientism is a religion. These people have the most intense blind faith of all. Do you know what that is? The most deepest blind faith that there is not belief in God or Yahweh or Allah or anything like that. That at least some reason, yeah, maybe there's somebody around who's maybe a little nicer than other people. Belief in nothing is the blindest thing possible, right? And that's what they believe. They have a picture, present company accepted. They all have a picture from their science class that when they die, they're going to enter like a black space of total peace and deep sleep. And they even have cemeteries called Heavenly Rest Cemetery. And that's what they think. They don't believe this. Some God is going to come along and take them up, you know. The God who didn't study at MIT is going to be able to take them up to heaven. They don't really believe that. A few fanatics maybe, but mostly they don't. They just think they don't have to worry about heaven or hell or, heavens to Betsy, another human life in a bad neighborhood because they're going to be nothing. They get out of the whole problem by dying. That's it. They lost all their stocks, lost all their everything, lost all their trophy wives, but there'll be nothing. There'll be nothing. That's the deepest blind faith of all. So that's a school. That's a school of religion. So in order to help people become inside and to replace that sense that at the bottom of this, like right here in this reality, if we analyze everything and take it apart, what is our picture of what is there? A dark space. What between the stars, between here and the moon, it's a dark space. When we fall asleep, we go in a dark room, we pass out, we go in a dark space. Inside the atom, we think there's a dark space. And a little flea-like electron is moving around. And like we somehow are walking around. Right? And we're still hoping that somebody finds something solid to overcome our dizziness. So how do you replace that with when, if you boil everything down, you eliminated every sort of differentiated thing, every kind of unpleasant thing, what would be there but nirvana? You would be floating in nirvana. You would totally let go. You would let go into a dark space. Even when you let into a dark space, since nothing is nothing, you won't be staying there. You'll just stop imposing your ideas on it, and then clear light of the void will arise, and you'll float in that. You will be that. Right? How are we going to help anybody come to that more, less paranoid notion if we don't engage with the science classes? Okay? And deal with it. Deal with the endlessness of life. Nobody, my favorite statement, nobody gets out of here a dead. Groundhog Day is one of the great Buddhist teachings. Bill Murray is my guru. Really? He's a Roshi. I'm sorry, Roshis. He doesn't have lineage, Bill Murray, in this life. But he's a Roshi, Bill Murray. He's a total Roshi. He got lost in translation. So right view, dialogue with science. And then also we have to revise the Abhidhamma. Do you know what I mean? We have to revise it. The Abhidhamma doesn't, you know, thinks the world is flat. The Abhidhamma doesn't know about a lot of things because they didn't have those things in those days. Although the Abhidhamma knows the mind very well, better than others, and the Abhidhamma knows better than not scientific materialists that we all had infinite previous lives. I'm sorry, that one thing is much more sensible. We'll have many future ones, and you won't even get out of it by becoming a Buddha. People go on and on, oh, last life, no more birth, oh, finished, everything's great. And then all the escapists think that's so great. And of course, people who don't know what Buddhism is, they get, oh, those people are really weird. They don't like life. Because they misunderstand that. They're not Indians who take for granted the endless continuum of lives. So they think, no more life. Oh, that's terrible. We all have no more life. We just shoot ourselves. We have no more life. So what's the big deal about that? They can't understand that at all. Right? So Buddha doesn't get out of it either. Did you ever hear of the Nirmanakaya? You know? And the Dharmakaya, even Theravada doesn't quite, they don't kind of like the Nirmanakaya. But the Buddha's always nirmanaing around in their scriptures. How do you think he gets his Ajatashatru? No, I don't mean Ajatashatru, I mean Angulimala. I just was reading the Angulimala thing. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh removes Angulimala, the magical element, because he wants to naturalize everything, which is wise for the audience. But in fact, the Buddha nirmanaed an emanation of to Angulimala that looked like his mother, the way the story is told in Theravada scripture. So Angulimala had been told by his teacher that the 1,000th person he should kill would be his mother, and then he would attain nirvana. That's why he was deludedly killing everybody. It was like somebody, some bad teacher was getting revenge on him. And so Buddha appeared like the mother, and then he was like Kung Fu mother. And Angulimala couldn't kill him. So then he says, okay, I know you're not my mother. You must be somebody else, and I give up. That's when then Buddha taught Angulimala. So that's nirmana. And it means emanate. So when you become everything, right, you become a Buddha, that means you are everything. Then you can manifest anything you want out of anything. And theoretically, we can't say you couldn't, you know. I mean, we can say, scientific materialism, of course, doesn't believe there is such a thing as a Buddha. If they actually saw a Buddha with his, like, extra scoop of brains, his weird earlobes, his webbed fingers like a platypus, and his weird genitalia, they would be very freaked out, and they would immediately take him to, like, Warehouse 1 or Warehouse 19 and start, you know, dissecting him to find out what was in the extra scoop of brains. So forget about it, you know, really, you know, getting them to think that Buddha was just extra cute Socrates with an orange toga. No way. I mean, that's not a bad thing to start there, but it won't stay there. So we can't overcome that it's a different vision of physics and reality. It's a different science. Buddhist science is a different science. And everything is possible in Buddhist science. And therefore, when you become Buddha, you are bound to do everything possible that can be done for every being. As you know, it is said in the scripture, the Buddha looks and sees every living being like a mother sees her only beloved child. Then people go, ah. Oh. But I go, poor Buddha. How would you like to be seeing every being, that means insect, animal, beings in hell, weird gods in weird kinky like heavens, you know, as your, like your only beloved child, you know? And having to do whatever it takes to get them out of their bags. So Buddha has infinite life. Amitayus means infinite life. So there's no last life. But of course, Buddha does it very effortlessly and happily because he's at the same time, he's aware that nothing much is going on. Nothing at all is going on even. Prajna Paramita. It's a shocking thing. None of this is happening. It's all unborn. And simultaneously to maintain awareness of that, while being involved in all the differentiation, is an inconceivability, of course. Inexpressible. That's why we talk about it all the time. Because it's inexpressible. So, back to nature, dealing with realistic worldview, and everybody, you know, I know meditating is a big thing, and I know mindfulness is very important, but you know, the first branch of the Eightfold Noble Path is not meditation, and it's not mindfulness. The first branch is realistic worldview. And realistic worldview is the same as prajna, you know, intelligence or wisdom. And wisdom means knowing what is real and knowing the difference between what is real and what is unreal. And of course, the knowing, ultimately empowered by samadhi, becomes a knowledge that is not a subject-object discursive dualistic knowledge, a formulaic knowledge, a conceptualizable knowledge. It is a visceral experiential knowledge. But don't pretend you can just hop over that first noble branch of the Eightfold Noble Path, realistic worldview. Realistic worldview means you have to correct critically in your mind the unrealistic worldview that the American nation lives in. Why is America so unrealistic? Because of its unrealistic worldview. And this is not a religious thing, it's a scientific thing, actually philosophical or scientific. On the one hand, you have religious people who are kind of going crazy, of course, because they're very frightened and they see the world this, and their wives divorce them at a higher rate than secular people. The highest divorce rate is amongst the fundamentalists in America. And so they're very nervous and frightened. So they think that God made the world to be used up by the oil industry and the lumber industry and the meat industry, and then when it's all used up, it'll be destroyed, and Jesus will save the owners of those industries. That's what they think. And that is totally unrealistic. Absolutely unrealistic. In fact, it's the very opposite of that, of what is going to happen. It's the very, very opposite of that. As Jesus said himself, he said, I don't know those guys. Don't come up here and say, Jesus, Jesus, you know. I want like a condo, free condo in heaven. No way. Mortgage revoked up there. And he said, right after the Sermon on the Mount, he said that. And he said, don't tell me you're going to come here after doing great deeds of power in my name. I don't know ye. Get ye gone, ye evildoers. That's what he said. Well, that's what they say, he said. Who knows? He was just trying to scare them, of course. He will, of course, deal with them, poor guy. It's like Buddha. So the point is, that's one side. And then the other side, unrealistic, super unrealistic side, is it all doesn't matter because it's all random mutation. Nobody knows, doesn't matter. And we're just an accident. But it's a bunch of accidents sitting around here. You know, happened in the backseat of a Chevrolet or something. Now you're running around being a Buddhist. Then you die and you're nothing and you never knew it happened. So it doesn't matter. And that's totally unrealistic. Realistic worldview is Omie dharma hetu prabhava hetun tesham tathagata hi avada tesham chayo nirodo evamvadi mahasramaniye swaha, right? That all things arise from causes. What are those causes and how to terminate them? This is the path taught by the great vacationer. Buddha is the great vacationer. Shramana doesn't mean ascetic. It means vacationer. Look at there he is, the great vacationer, Joseph. Joseph is a super vacationer up there in Massachusetts. He's on an endless forest retreat. That is not asceticism. That is a vacation. Believe me, I'm looking for retirement from my academic sludge work, and that is a vacation, living there happily in the forest. But thank heavens there's some people doing that. But I'll get to that in Right Ethics. Okay, excuse me. I just see that happy face there. Okay, realistic intention. Realistic intention not to convert others from inherited religions, but serve them and welcome them without demanding denominational allegiance. Very light on any kind of let's be Buddhist sort of thing and denominational card-carrying business, etc. This should allow double participation. And then I made a list. Indigen Boo, Chris Boo, Jew Boo, of course that's what everybody knows, Hin Boo, Mus Boo, Dao Boo, Babu. Nobody knows what a Babu is. That's a Baha'i Buddhist. Babu, Jain Boo, Sikh Boo, Shin Boo. And any other Boos? A Sek Boo, I guess, would be a secular humanist Buddhist. So that's all fine. Don't be Buddhist. Be compassionate, be wise, be happy. Right? That's the thing. Now, some religions will object to this double thing. They don't like Jew Boo. Although I had a talk once in the Jewish Community Center in San Francisco, and the rabbis were a bit nervous, but they cheered up a lot. When I told them, I said, listen, guys, don't worry about all the Jew Boos. If they come home and they say, I'm a Boo, then you worry. As long as it's a Jew Boo, you're cool. They did, two of them laughed. Realistic speech. A strong focus on communication. Presenting ideas, practices, ethical guidelines, institutional activities in comprehensible way. Use in media, make enlightening artworks, films, etc. Where's more Buddhist films? There is the great Buddhist film festival thing going on that our friend does from San Francisco. That's wonderful, you know. And then there's Dharma publications, you know, Daido, your colleague, your lineage colleague, Daido, he does a great job with that. And everybody does, but we have to really flood the waves. Where's our Buddhist TV show? Where's my evening Buddhist comedy show? And you'd be a perfect guest, permanent guest. Maybe you'd be a perfect moderator, so I think I don't have the strength. But we need to get out there more in a relaxed way. This is happening, but it needs to be done more. also very much focus we should have in realistic speech on education and the educational professions and industries. Hooray Naropa, and hooray all Buddhist studies in different universities. They should be supported, they should happen. But people who support them should really try to find out before they make big Buddhist studies things if the professors in charge actually like Buddhism. I'm afraid there's a lot of my colleagues who make a profession of studying it who have like practically a professional like entry point into the profession that you have to not like it. I'm not kidding. I'm a little bit of a heretic in their view, from an academic point of view, because it's known that I somewhat like Buddhism. I can't help it. It's fairly likable. I mean, I like Christianity too. I like Islam too. I can go Allahu Akbar. I don't mind that. You know, I don't like the bad aspects of any of them. But actually, I do admire Buddhism. It really has a good record in history. It really does well. So people who are like going to support Buddhist studies, make sure the people doing it actually like it. Because it's then otherwise people will feel disappointed. You know, oh, we tried to do Buddhist studies and then they didn't do anything. They just sat around and whatever, wrote a book about how Buddha like had a, you know, limped. Buddha had a limp. Or Buddha had flat feet or something. You know, that darn thousand poke wheel in the bottom of his foot wasn't that thousand poke wheel. It was like some Dr. Scholl's like cure for flat feet. So the education thing is key because the young come through the universities. And they definitely should encounter Buddha in those universities. Not because they should be Buddhist. No. But because nobody accuses the philosophy department that they're trying to make worshippers of Apollo because they go and lead Socrates. You know, because they read, they're not accused of trying to make people Jewish or Christian because they read the scriptures, the Western scriptures. Or they're, you know, so they should be reading the dialogues of the Buddha like the dialogues of Plato. They are philosophical dialogues. They are against the caste system. They are against, you know, misogyny. They are against all kinds of things. They are very, very amazingly inspiring, and they should be part of a real curriculum in real education. It's ridiculous, this Western curriculum stuff. Really. I have it at Columbia, and my Buddhism course is in what's called extended core. It's very nice that they extended something. We're happy. But why is it only an extended core? It is the axial age. They should have read Karen Armstrong, but or they could have read Toynbee or Carl Jaspers decades ago. The axial age, Socrates and the pre-Socratics and all of them happened the same time. All the Buddhist universities were 10 times bigger than the Platonic Academy. And they were 10 times, 100 times better funded. And they had 1,000 times bigger number of students. And they had million times more enlightened kings that supported those institutions. Confucius also was like Socrates, always running around, didn't get tenure. He had to teach in his kitchen. His wife had to cook for the students because the dukes wouldn't hire him because he was too ethical for them, you know? The rulers. You know, and India was by far and away the more enlightened society, and therefore the great teachers of 2,500 years ago, the Dharma could be, the wheel could really be turned. That's why Buddha went there. So the universities, and finally the translation and publication of the Buddhist scriptures to date in all languages, not just English, is a major priority in the world. You know, there's only really Pali, Sanskrit, Chinese are the only canonical languages, and Tibetan are really the only canonical languages. Then from Tibetan there was translations into Mongolian. Then the Japanese read the Chinese ones, and then they have kind of commentaries and they have cribs. You know, kind of like trots, you know, what we call them, you know, they have in Japanese. But there's still not very many still. Where's the German Gandhur and Tendur? And even the Chinese don't have the Tendur. The Chinese canon does not have all the shastras of the great Indian masters who taught the Dharma. You know. Yes, Zen is teaching, but Zen is not a scripturalist tradition. Or rather, being a scripturalist tradition lines Zen up with the scripturalist scripture. You know what that is? Prajnaparamita sutras. Every other page they say there's no sutra, there's no wisdom, there's no Buddha, there's no scripture, there's no non-scripture. That's the scriptural of scripture. Six patriarch got enlightenment hearing the Diamond Sutra because somebody translated it into Chinese. So we do need a little bit of support to the translators. And then widely. They're all living here in grandma's attic usually. translating some new text and trying to find a publisher. And then the usual Dharma publisher who doesn't give much royalty. Then they have to go live with grandma. That's really not nice. You know? And then in academia, they don't, well, who needs a translation from that? You know, Loka Chakshu, ancient Tibet, translator was called Loka Chakshu, like the public eye. I love the expression. It's like private eye, you know, like an investigator. A public eye, an eye of the people. And they were incredibly honored. Actually, in China, they even had a war over some of the great translators. The different kings and dynasties tried to capture this translator to translate more scriptures because they felt it was so important. Then they actually had fights over Kumarajiva, famous Central Asian translator. And the reason they did is because they weren't arrogant in that sense. The Chinese Buddhists, the Tibetan Buddhists, they felt that India was a higher country, had a higher culture. So when they translated things from that language, they were elevating their culture. Our Anglo culture is so arrogant, we think we already know everything. And anything that anybody ever thought in an ancient time or in another culture or another tradition was some like backward, pre-modern thing that didn't know anything about. They didn't have subways and Ford motor cars and so forth, and General Motors, so they were backward. Meanwhile, we're backward. We're like practically destroying the planet. Did you notice? Have you noticed? And look at we have now a nice revolutionary in the White House, but look at what they're screaming at him. They're paralyzing him. They're crippling him. Did you notice? Because the culture is too backward. So therefore, people who bring something in, who they translate from Machig Labdrin, totally enlightened woman, previous life of Michelle probably, when they translate her teachings about how you deal with these demonic people, you feed them, feed your body to them. The Jura ritual. Unbelievably great thing. How do you heal the environment? You feed it with your body. And then that's not looking into something higher. A great insight like that. So people who translate should, that need some kind of R-E-S-P-E-C-T. That's all I'm saying. Okay? So that's right speech, okay? And now we get down to right action. Although, you know, I don't think karma, I call karma evolutionary action. And here, right evolutionary action means karmanta, you know, kamanta, it said. Anta means terminal, end of action. They don't just say samyak samakama. They say samakamanta. The anta means terminal, end of action. And the end of action means that it's all those actions that lead you to freedom from suffering, not actions that lead you into more and more engagement in the toils of the suffering life cycle. And so here, why, you know, it's amazing. And here I have to praise Thich Nhat Hanh, actually. He blew my mind. You know, remember some of you, but it's the older teachers here will remember, but it's teachers, the 1997, I think it was, Time Magazine did a special issue on Buddhism. They had Brad Pitt on the cover wearing his Tibetan jacket from his part in the 7 years in Tibet. And it was like, Buddhism sweeps America, or some baloney like that. And they really didn't like me, because when they interviewed me, they said, oh, and then afterwards they said I was the Jeremiah of American Buddhism. Because I said that Buddhism, there was no Buddhism. We don't have Buddhism here yet. Don't tell me Buddhism is here. Well, there's a few people like doing some meditating, other people reading some books. You know, some people trying to be a little nicer. We don't really have Buddhism. And they said, why not? I said, well, there's two levels in Buddhist history where you have to have the Eightfold Path to have Buddhism. And the Eightfold Path has eight branches. And the first branch is in realistic worldview. And realistic worldview means embracing the infinite causality within which we are, within which dependent origination has us enfolded. Everything is interdependent. You know, and nirvana is that interdependence. It's not outside of it. It is its deeper nature, but it supports it. It's there. And so even we stay with it, even we're in nirvana, out of compassion for those who are not realizing that it's nirvana. And so realistic worldview is not some notion of a termination of the universe. It is not a notion that the universe terminates in nothingness at death. It is not some, and therefore there's no problem with no former and no future life. And I'm a modern Buddhist and I don't need no future life. I'm an American. I'm getting it all in this life. And I'm going to the Zen Center for the quick retreat. I'm going to get enlightenment by the end of that. Or I'm going to take Tantra. I'll get the special teaching of the Guru and I'll be enlightened in 3 years. Or 3 weeks or 3 days. It's getting down to here. You get the really super special one. With the extra brocade and the super horns. And the high price. Forget about it. Forget about it. Life after life. To get out of this being this kind of like whatever. Weird person. And get the body of beatitude, sambhogakaya, and the ability of emanating, you know, transporting yourself without a transporter room, anywhere where beings need your help. The real sci-fi, but the only way you can understand Buddhism is you have to be a sci-fi fan. I'm sorry. I'm not just jazzing it up. That Buddhism is sci-fi. As far as materialists go, it's not actually fine. It's scientific reality, actually. Physics of the event horizon, of the infinite energy of the void. The void has infinite energy. Like they discovered, they didn't even discover that with their mathematics. They got like, whoa, zero has black hole, zero ill density. Occasionally they seem to explode and we have universes. Infinite energy of the vacuum. What is that? It's just the clear light of the void. It's the vajra of compassion of all enlightened beings and of yourself, actually. Because the all enlightened, you realize that all enlightened beings think that we are, that they are us. Do you realize that? Isn't that embarrassing? We are dragging all enlightened beings around by them having to be us because they are indivisible from us. The Dharmakaya is infinitely embraces all things. It is all things. So when I'm sniveling and messing around and having a temper tantrum and freaking out and being envious or jealous or greedy, I am dragging down the Dharmakaya. It's embarrassing. Fortunately, Dharmakaya doesn't mind. But he's getting the closest to what Buddha did in India. He's like walking around with people. And he, I was talking about Dina. So then I said, there's no former future life here amongst the American Buddhists, much. They're very proud that we're so modern, we don't need that. Wrong. They need that. It isn't that it's an ultimate thing. You know, there's a Buddhist hermeneutic or interpretive thing that no teaching about relative reality is absolute. And the absolute is pure negation, lack of suffering, nirvana. That's why nirvana is a negative term. Nirodha is a negative term. Shunyatas are all negative term. You know, emptiness, voidness. So it isn't some sort of dogma in a certain way, but within descriptions of the relative world, the description that causality just goes into nothing is insane. It is unrealistic view. And even on the surface of the language, it's a misuse of language in a Wittgensteinian type of Buddhism. No way that something can become nothing. Just nothing is nothing. Eureka. Did you ever really think about it? People run around existentialists, I'm afraid of nothing. That's a ridiculous thing. Some other person who's a big hero says, I'm afraid of nothing. And we know what that means. That means they're not afraid of anything because they know that nothing is nothing. Some other people who get confused, they go and say, I'm afraid of nothingness. Oh, nothingness will get me. Nobody's afraid of nothing. But to expect to be nothing is insane. Conservation of energy. Nobody has ever found nothing. They've never seen anything become nothing. It is completely unrealistic worldview. You're all going to be something forever. Okay, so that was one reason I said Buddhism is not here yet. Because nobody, we have not really knuckled under to our long-term commitment to the infinite consequences of how we live and what we do. If we did, we would be freaking out in a good way more than we do. We would not be, you know, driving our Chevy to the levee quite so casually in between sessions. In between sessions, then, oh, I did a session, I'm going to take a break, drive my Chevy to the levee. No, we wouldn't be doing that. Because we know that these moments are infinitely precious, because if we do not use these moments now to awaken, we may have many boring moments where we wouldn't even hear about it. In other lifetimes, forms, planets, societies, even if we're human. It's a very frightening thing, the abyss of the infinity of future existences. We do so many negative things, we have so many negative thoughts, and if they're all going to have consequences, we want to really not have them. So we become really mindful. It's a wonderful thing, Samadhi Raja Sutra, who understands cause and effect, rationally and realistically understands voidness and selflessness. Who understands voidness and selflessness, that person is truly mindful. I love that. It doesn't mean that person can float around and hang out because they got voidness somewhere. They got it. Nobody gets voidness. Voidness has us already. We just don't know it yet. We may then, if we come to know it, then what we know is that we better pay attention to every tiny little thing because it all matters and nothing disappears. And it vitally matters to every being. And even we get to a point where we are a little cooler about it because we are happy, because we feel the happy energy. We know how much it matters to others, and they are the same as us. So poor, you become Buddha, you're bound to the suffering of others. Anyway, luckily you can help that because you see through it also. You know it's like a movie, like an illusion. But you know it isn't like that to them, so you're 100% committed to it. So okay, the former teacher's like, I'm sorry, I can't help it with a Buddhist thing. You've got to deal with it. Second, I said, we don't have monasticism in this country. There's no American Buddhist monasticism. Yes, we have Vietnamese monks. Yes, we have Tibetan monks. Yes, we have Sri Lanka, Thai monks, Burmese monks. We invite them over. Yes, Bhikkhuji, here, have a thing. The Asian Buddhists have some monks. Yes, they need their monks, yes. We Americans, we don't need monks. We're all like Americans. We have our wives. We don't need monks. Our wives are teaching us celibacy when we reach a certain age. They are teaching us self-restraint. And we need that teaching, actually. I'm not knocking that. But we also inflict a lot of our passions on our wife. We also distract ourselves too much. And we also prevent them from practicing by making them run around chasing children and doing things, washing dishes and things. They might like to do. You know, the reason that the Buddha was hesitant to have a bhikshuni sangha is not because he was a chauvinist like my academic colleagues are constantly trying to prove. They're going, oh, Buddha was a big chauvinist. He said no to Mahat Prajapati for 3 times and he made him stand in the dirt there. What a mean chauvinist he was. That's what they love, that thing. You can get tenure with that thesis. Buddha, because the American academics feel good if everybody else is equally stupid as them. No, they don't like it if someone's better than them, especially in the earlier era. Everyone has to be dragged down to the same old level of imperfection that no one can ever develop and be better. That's really a very important thing in America. That's democracy, after all. We couldn't have an enlightened person here, really, because that wouldn't be democratic. Everybody has to be the same. And of course, everybody thinks enlightenment is some sort of great state above everybody else. And they don't realize that it isn't. It's being, in fact, more with everybody else than anybody else is. Poor enlightened people. Poor people. Anyway, luckily they have a little juice from Nirvana, but otherwise, what a pain in the neck. Apparently. So we don't have monasticism because, and we think that's because we're so smart and we're like, you know, we've read Freud and we know about it's unconscious and eros and sexuality and blah, 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 you know. And we think monks are kind of weird and uptight and freaked out, old fashioned. And we think that's from some great enlightened thing, but it isn't. It's just because we're caught in a culture which still has a WASP atmosphere. A Protestant ethic, no free lunch. You gotta work. You gotta produce. You're worthless unless you work and you produce. We're not giving nobody no free lunch. Buddha and his guys, they're getting a lot of free lunches in here. They're going down and people are falling all over themselves to be the one to put the free lunch in the Buddha's bowl. And that, because India was rich enough, they had agricultural surplus. And they delighted in giving away that free lunch. They delighted that somebody was freer than them, even if they themselves didn't leave their farm and join, which many of them did. Because when you realize that what's in your mind could determine your evolutionary history for 1,000 lifetimes, 1,000,000 lifetimes, then you really want to take care of what's in your mind. You really want an undistracted setting. You want an environment. You want a lifelong MacArthur Fellowship. Right away. You don't need such an expensive thing when you don't have a lot of children and mortgages and things like that. You just go around to some vihara there. And you get in a little bamboo hut. and whatever, you know. Bimbisara comes and gives you lunch. And we don't have that generosity of spirit in American Buddhism. And also not me, I'm just a professor, but the leaders of American Buddhism, mostly, are ex-monks. Quite a few of them. And I know some of them, and they say, you know, well, we like monks, but you know what? We're the boss here. And there's this annoying thing that lay people should defer to monks in some respects. And there are a lot of other like monks. So there isn't this respect of the office. But we have to learn that. Even if someone is ignorant, even if someone is just beginning, even if someone is like these little boys and this little Swasti boy or little Rahula, Buddha's son, and they're not yet mature and they're just learning a little bit mindfulness and this and that. We have to respect that they are living for the infinite future. That's what being a monk is for. It is like working in the factory of creating the enlightened bodhicitta, the spirit of awakening, the soul of awakening. Don't tell me Buddhists don't have a soul. They do. They have this relational continuum process. The anatma translation as no soul is not correct. I mean, yes, there's no soul. Jiva means soul. There's no soul. The same kind of language where Buddha teaches there's no soul and no self. He says there's no nose. There's no ear and no eye. I don't see you people running around saying, I'm a Buddhist, so I have no nose. The no nose means that your nose is only a relative thing and it's constantly changing. And it's like going to droop right off your face when you die. That's what no nose means. It doesn't mean that there's no relational process here that we can like, you know, that serves as our lifelong hood ornament. That's the nose. So the subtle continuum of a being that goes from life to life is a soul, can be called a soul, a jiva, a relational one. But Buddha tended to say no to people because they're also hung up on some immortal, unchanging one, which they were unrealistically think was outside of causality. And God was going to take to heaven, or they were going to take into Nirvikalpa Samadhi, or they were going to take into a nirvana, which was basically a state of non-existence, to be free from suffering. So he emphasizes the no-self and no-everything. He goes ahead and Prajnaparamita goes on for 100,000 lines, and even that's a small fragment of the Prajnaparamita, no-everything. No toe, no foot, no nothing. Not particularly picking on the self and the soul. No Buddha, and no non-Buddha. So there, but there is Buddha, and there are non-Buddhas. There is a nose. Anyway, so Manah, when are we getting the generosity from now? For example, here in Naropa. We have the new president, I think, of Naropa here. This is wonderful. Naropa is always fundraising. One of the reasons that fundraising, well, not only you, Harvard is funded. Harvard is also losing its money in between. The man who helped them lose their money is now losing the government's money. It's very encouraging, I think. This might wake up the government, too. But anyway, Harvard should wake up. But how much nicer if some part of the faculty didn't need a big salary because they were monastics. That was the Buddha's institutional cleverness. His teachers were, they had no benefits, no salary, just a free lunch. And a couple of robes. And some tweezers. And some sandals after a while. And then you can have a lot of teachers, and they were great teachers. They were then not in it for the money. You know, I'm reluctant to say this in non-Buddhist universities because the administrators will take it seriously. And they'll reduce our salaries even more. And we're lay people and we have to have a salary. But point is, we need monasticism in America if we want to have American Buddhism. There can be different forms of it, of course. We could maybe have a little quasi, like for a few years, like in Thailand type of thing. Maybe that doesn't have to be all lifelong. But we should have the generosity to dish out a lot of free lunches to people who want it. To people who are really sincere, who really are vetted by the senior people that they really want. And they shouldn't have to be constantly working for a living. They're meditating for life, all life, not working for a living. They're living to meditate. They're living to realize enlightenment. They're living for freedom. That we say we're individualistic society. We say we're individualistic society. We respect the individual. Well, the highest thing any individual can do is liberate their heart and their mind and become a part of the solution to evolution and not more of the problem of evolution. And those beings who do that, therefore, are doing the highest thing a human being can do. And if we're truly an individualistic, if we're truly all for the one, if we have true individualism, we will support them. Why do you think India is such an individualistic country compared to us? I go through this with my students all the time. And they look very doubtful about India being individualistic more than us, because they never went to a Kumbh Mela. Kumbh Mela, you have 80,000 people, 80 million people assemble at the confluence of the Yamuna and the Ganga. And they are mostly stark naked, all hanging out, the real meaning of hanging out. And they have painted some color, and they're going ram ram, whatever. They never go bud bud, but I'm after them on that one. But, and they have cow caca hairdos. And they're all painted in their way. They really got their war paint on. That's individualism. They can walk in the street. And people, when they argue with me, my students in classes, and they say, but we Americans are rugged individuals. I say, okay, strip naked, paint yourself blue, put a cow caca hairdo on, and walk down Broadway and ask for a free lunch. And see what happens. Librium. Prozac, even worse. Institutionalization in the wrong way. So we need this. And this is activists. In a Protestant, industrial, overproducing, overproductive, polluting, destructive country, we now have destroyed China lately. We think it's a miracle. We destroy it. We put all our polluting industries in there. And there now their environment is ruined. They have some dollar bills which are now becoming quickly worthless. And their country's polluted totally, water, air, everything. The headwaters of their rivers, the glaciers, headwaters are melting. So, monasticism. Imagine if we produce less. We talk about it, living without growth. We put the growth in the opposite direction. Tibet, for example, is a country that is an example of that. It is the extreme attempt to put the Buddhist Sangha in the center of a country. And it inflicted its own extremeness on Mongolia, actually, afterwards. And it's extreme in the sense that it completely disbanded the military. Thailand did not. Sri Lanka did not. They never did. Tibet did disband it. And the monastics got the whole of the national treasury. It's like the Tibetan Pentagon was a monastery. And before that, they had a Pentagon. They conquered a lot of places. They conquered China even once. They were vicious and nasty and beating up their wives. Ferocious, strong people. And then they just became, their ferocity comes out in debating about Shunyata. And then, of course, they're vulnerable, and they got trampled in this last century. And I'm not saying we can get there that easy or that quickly, but we really need that in this country to undo our militarism and to undo our overproduction, our greed, and our violence. We need monasticism. Young people, we have the Catholic one, but it's very understaffed. And they're trying to justify their existence by making jam and wine and so on. You know, and people, Protestant people think, well, they must be weird, had an unhappy sex life or something. Psychologists try to analyze Buddha and say he had a really unhappy sex life. I congratulate Thich Nhat Hanh. He realized how much in love Buddha was with the Yashodhara. In the Buddhacharita, the great poem of Ashvaghosham Buddha, Buddha had such a great sex life that when he and Yashodhara, who were deeply, deeply in love for many years, and remained so even, I mean, his love for her inspired him on the path to become enlightened. He didn't just abandon her, he just expanded to be in love with all beings like he loved her. And he really honors that. The first time I've seen someone honor that. But anyway, I love the thing in Ashvaghosha. They were on their honeymoon, they were making love, they were so into it, they fell off the roof of their pleasure pavilion. Luckily, it was a one-story building, and there was a big lotus bed underneath, and they landed in the lotus bed, and they didn't know they had fallen off. I think that's called getting it on. And the men's game and held it up. So Buddha, by no means, was sort of freaked out because he lost his mom, and you know he didn't want to be a male, and like things that the psychiatrists get into about Buddha. It's ridiculous. Really silly. And so monasticism is not a running away from something. It's a higher eros. It's a higher sensitivity. It's a seeking of a higher bliss. And to secure that bliss for all beings, too. Monasticism is altruistic. You know, people go into monasteries because they realize that their mind has a lot of harmful thoughts in it, and that they do harm to people without even meaning to, that they say things that are hurtful, that they lose their temper, that they're too greedy and so forth, and they cheat people and do things, and they go there, at least they want to do no harm. And so they go to a place where they can live at a higher level of mindfulness, because they're supported in that higher level of mindfulness. And you know, we have the Zen people, and they've become a very powerful institution, and governments are afraid of them. Now, the Zen people lost that celibacy aspect, lifelong celibacy aspect, because the Japanese government banned it in the 19th century. Not because the Zen people got so enlightened and they didn't need to be monks. Hakuin remained a monk. They did. Because they realized what it meant as an institution in a society. It is a true way of changing a society. You want activism, you create a place where people can live free for life while meditating. And you put some stocks and bonds under that. And you don't say that you go and do something useful. If they want to do something useful, it must be a monk hitting there or two. Thanks for the thing. And if you want to do something useful, you know, they can. Monks end up doing it because they get some of them get bored. And they decide to become a doctor or a nurse or a lawyer or whatever. Or they decide to go and feed somebody or whatever. They do that a lot. But they don't have to. That's key. They're supported just for their quest and their closeness to freedom. And that's... We are a freedom, land of the free. Where's the free? There's no free lunch. It's not land of the free lunch. Until it's land of the free lunch, it's not land of the free. Okay? So anyway, coming back to Thich Nhat Hanh. When I said that, until we have real free monasticism here, until the wealth of the Buddhist community is put under some monks and nuns in a big way, until... For everyone becomes where it's common sense, not mysticism, to realize that they better prepare for the next life. And many more. And also that we've had many past ones. And therefore we've all been in it together forever. All of us. You know, there's not just that I irritate you this life. I irritated you many lives. And I will continue to do so many lives. Until I and you shape up. Then that gives us a different way of relating now. Then we are more careful how we relate to each other now. It's a total life-changing, realistic worldview, critical switch. And it is not a matter of some sort of mystical belief. It's a matter of looking critically at how we basically are not accepting causality. Om ye dharma hetu prabhava. That all things are born of cause is what they said. When Asvajit said to the Sariputra, which is what brought Sariputra to the Buddha, he realized that cause, accepting causality, accepting my embeddedness in relativity, that is the beginning of enlightenment. And that is perhaps the end of enlightenment as well. So, okay. So then Thich Nhat Hanh, then about a week after that Time magazine came out, on a Friday I was about to leave for the weekend. I was at home, not in the office. And the secretary of the Religion Department of Columbia calls up hysterical. There's like a whole bunch of weird people over here. They say they're Buddhist monks and nuns, and they like want to see you. And I said, okay. And there's like a lot of them, and they're all filling up the office. I don't know what to do. So I went over there. Thich Nhat Hanh had come to the Religion Department office with about 75 monks and nuns. And they were in the receptionist place, standing behind her desk. She was actually getting a break, but she was so nervous. They were in the office, they were in the meeting room, they were in my office. And I said, oh, hello, Ty, how are you? You know, they said, we all wanted to come here to show you that there are some happy monks and nuns. Americans can be happy monks and nuns, and to congratulate you for saying that. We're so happy you said that, he said. And now we want you to come out and take a walk with us. So we walked out around the Riverside Church and the Union Seminary where Thich Nhat Hanh had studied it one time. It was really, really sweet. But at first he said, but the reason we all came in, he said, is because you translated the Vimalakirti Sutra, and I want to see you fit us all into this room. Okay, I'm sorry, Ty, I just translated the sutra. I'm not Doctor Who, you know, and I can't make it. Not yet, not this life. I can't make the room fit with the millions of members of the Sangha. But anyway, I wanted to praise Thich Nhat Hanh. I'm sorry, long digression. I wanted to praise Thich Nhat Hanh Because he does this. He goes out. He has 1,000 people, 2,000 people walking with him in Ohio. Usually some semi-enlightened place. I don't know if he's really much walked in Harlem and so on, but maybe he has. And I'm going to invite him, actually, to go to a really serious, bad place. And next year, I mean, 2011. Maybe he does it already. I don't know for sure. But that is really it. That's where it comes out. That's where it will happen. Then we'll see American Buddhism. That's where it has to be, you know. The Nichiren Nyōhoji people do that. The ones who did the longest walk with the Native Americans. You know, they were against the Japanese war effort during the war. They were the only Japanese sect that really was against the government. Therefore, they were imprisoned, a lot of them. It's all of the Nichiren. It's that particular group within, you know, Ichidatsu Fuji, you know. Fuji Guruji, you know about him. Fuji Guruji, he was a friend of Gandhi and all of them. He made the wheel on the Indian flag. And he used to go and protest the Japanese war effort and get arrested by Japan and exiled and so on. So there are, you know, that more out there with the people, not making them Buddhist, but asking for lunch and out there walking and out there being peace. Peace is every step. I think Thich Nhat Hanh is the closest to what Shakyamuni did in India, he's doing in the West. It's closest, really. But in a way, he can't completely do that. Dalai Lama maybe would like to. He does yatras in India, actually, peace walks. But Dalai Lama is not free to really be a guru. I don't know if you guys realize that. He can't really be a Dharma teacher, poor guy, because of this political thing. He has to represent his people, primary duty. He can come to give some lectures here and there, but he can't really just go mainly as a Dharma teacher, except with his own Tibetans to keep their Dharma alive. He has to represent a people, you know. He's a head of state, although an unrecognized one. So Thay is ahead of him in that sense that he goes out and walks with the people, gets them to walk. And there's so many of the people in the Buddha's thing, the way he sees it, which I think is the right way, they just see the Buddha walking in the street and they just want to join that. And they like, it's like people throwing away, you could see a commercial in the future of American Buddhism, somebody sitting at a desk, you know, insurance actuary, you know, type HMO, typing in ways of getting people to get them off their insurance when they get cancer. You know, and the whole row of them, like in Brazil, you know, in rows of bureaucratic desks, and then some bhikkhus walk by, mindfully, peace is every step, breathing, and these people suddenly leaving their desks, throwing away their computer, dropping their blackberries, and walking, peace is every step. I could see a great Buddhist commercial. Realistic livelihood. Choice of profession important. Non-violence is a guideline. No meat. We really should join the meat, the vegan movement in this country. I'm a really guilty Tibetan yak eater. I have been. And sort of defensively like, well, Buddha said the monks could accept meat as long as they didn't kill it when they saw it, blah, 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 long excuses. The Japanese guys munching their sushi. Well, it's just a fish. A lot of them, sometimes it's a dolphin. Too much excuses. We really need the nonviolence. The meat industry is a major, even in this pollution business, greening of the green, you know, and the carbon monoxide and methane, whatever. Nobody's talking about the methane from the billions of 60 billion cows. You realize how much poop that is? We're only 6 billion humans on the whole planet. 60 billion cows in these feedlots, creating these poison cesspools, pigs, chickens, and these inhumane factory things. Forget about it. Livelihood today, Buddha were here today, I'm sorry, I think, well, of course, you know what I mean, you know what, if like some insane, like, you know, Republican warmonger who wanted to nuke, you know, Afghanistan or something, you know, challenged us that if you have a burger with me, I'll stop bombing, then you will have a burger. But, other than that, we should really join the movement to stop the Holocaust against the animals. We really should. There's really no excuse. I'm sorry. And besides which, that rubber chicken is killing you anyway. It is. Read the China study by T. Colin Campbell. It's just killing you. It just destroys the immune system's ability to keep the cancer cells down. It's just terrible. Realistic livelihood. So nonviolent guidelines. And also, what companies do we own? What companies are the endowments in? What are those companies really doing? We should really look at it seriously. The Buddhist movement should. It should raise people's awareness about that. The green orientation is very, very good. Mental health and physical health professions and industries. That's why Naropa, who does a lot of psych degrees, I think, you give here, quite a lot. One of the things people can earn a living from what they do here, I believe, is your psych degree, from what I've seen. Unfortunately, being a Buddhist studies scholar is not a livelihood, very helpful thing nowadays, because there's hiring freezes, everything's going broke. You know, the militarism is sucking up all the money, the universities are losing it, and it's a really terrible situation. So being health industries are wonderful. Doctors, acupuncturists, Ayurvedic healers, Tibetan medicine, this is really wonderful what to do. And the farming, urban farming, or green farming, all this kind of thing. Realistic creative effort. We're up to six. Actually, I like to translate, you know, samyak vidya, you know, yandakbe, zhenzhu. I like zhenzhu's creativity, because it doesn't just mean effort. You can make effort in robbing banks. You know, it means effort in the virtue, toward virtue. It means effort toward enlightenment. So I like to call it creativity. Because creativity is a kind of joyful effort towards something positive. And it isn't any kind of effort. You know, you can make effort to make a bomb or something. You know? So the institutional choices should be inspired. We should not avoid political activism. We should do political activism. The Buddhist vote, we should be able to threaten politicians with the Buddhist vote. I told Mayor Bloomberg he would get the Buddhist vote if he would do some this and that. And he just said, what are there, 10,000 of you here in New York? It was a joke, you know, anyway. I said, no, there's like millions of us, you don't realize it. We don't advertise. Actually, one of the great things about the fact that everybody's a Hindu and a Jew boo and a sect boo and every other kind of boo is that we can count among the near Buddhist numbers, the Buddhistic, let's say, the Buddhistized, the insiders, those who are feeling a refuge in the universe, we can count among them what they call, the sociologists call, the cultural creatives. And, you know, that I forget the name of that author, but that's a great book. Obviously, sociologists who lived in San Francisco. But the cultural creatives number 55 million in that book, and probably more today. You know, that includes, like, the yoga movement, all kinds of things. And New Agers, too. I hate it when I hear Buddhists, like, dumping on New Agers. Oh, that's New Age. What are they, like, the old age? They're all for old age? New Agers are great, man. So they think they came from Venus and they took the Dharma on Venus. Maybe they do teach the Dharma on Venus. Who cares? If that's where Shirley heard the Dharma, that's fine. The point is, if we're cultural creatives, then the movement is 55 million strong, which is lucky because the fundamentalists are 65 million strong. Okay? So, human rights, healing, progressive. You know, I like the Buddhist movement should really save Tibet. Not just because they're Buddhists, but because they were this extreme experiment. They were the country that put the free lunch in the center of the national budget, basically. I mean, not perfect. They're not Muslim. Shangri-La. Shangri-La's in the North Pole someplace, or nobody knows where it is. It's a myth. They know that they're not Shangri-La. They are very imperfect. They are not enlightened by any means. But the society adopted the principles, Vinaya-type principles, as best it could, minus, of course, vegetarianism, because they hadn't much vegetables now. But they will in the future. The Dalai Lama says one good thing Chinese did was brought us the knowledge of making greenhouses. Unfortunately, they ate all the food they grew by coming there and didn't give it to the Tibetans. But later, when we Tibetans are more free, we can use the greenhouses and have a better vegetarian diet, Dalai Lama says.